Roger Hodgson can comfortably lay claim to being one of the most gifted composers and lyricists of our time. Mr. Supertramp, as his fans persist in calling him, was one of the founding members of the most famous progressive rock group of the 70s and 80s and the voice of their biggest hits. Dreamer, The Logical Song, Give a Little Bit, Breakfast in America, It's Raining Again, Take the Long Way Home, all written by Roger Hodgson, all sung by him in that distinctive tenor voice which became the trademark sound of Supertramp. 3 decades later, he's still writing and playing and performing music for the legions of fans around the world. He'll be here in Wellington on April the 13th, and the next day he plays Auckland. Roger, lovely to have you on.
Jim, great to talk to you.
It's going to be a busy time for you. You're doing Germany and Brazil and Australia as well.
Definitely going to be transversing the planet this year. Yeah.
It's been an awfully long time since you were here. And in that time, you've stayed current, you've stayed popular, the gigs roll on, the music keeps coming.
Yep.
What's the key to that sort of longevity?
You know, I wish I could bottle it. No, I'm joking. No, it really amazes me, actually, how well my songs have stood the test of time. And that's not only for the public, but for me also. I mean, I have been on the road now for the last 6 years, doing tours every year. And it amazes me how I never get tired of singing these songs.
Well, they're high-quality songs, which explains part of it. Also, they never sound old. You know how a lot of old hits sound like the period they came from?
Yep.
Yours, without trying to be cliched about it, yours seem to have a timeless quality to them.
They do. Yeah, they're very evergreen. I think people ask, why is that so? And I can only say that, they were songs that were not contrived. They really did come from a real pure, deep place in me. And maybe that was the reason that, they have survived and they still sound very current. I mean, I can't think of one song I sing now where I go, oh, I wish I'd written something differently for that or anything. I mean, the lyrics still even are very pertinent to me and even pertinent for the times we're in.
Pertinent and highly redolent, I think. Mm-hmm. A lot of people grew up with those lyrics, and those lyrics are impossible to dislodge from your head as well. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about Supertramp and everything that came with it shortly as well, but there's been as much success for you solo, really, as there was as part of the group. You were ready to go from Supertramp in 1983, and there's been a lot of online speculation, because you've got a big fan base, a lot of online speculation about why you left. Can you clarify that? Because there are different stories online.
My, yeah, I know there's many, many rumors and stories online. Really, for me, primarily the reason that I made the choice finally was that I was really looking at two paths ahead of me. I could either continue with Supertramp. At that point, I'd been, the driving force behind the band for 14 years, and it had been my life totally. But suddenly, I was looking at two small children, and I was realizing that if I don't stop and learn how to be a parent, that I will probably be looking back in 20 years' time with deep regret and have missed out on something that's incredibly precious. And so I really made what was a very unpopular decision to say, listen, guys, I think I've got to call it quits and stop and learn how to be a parent, be a dad. And as I sit here today, I really have no regrets. Within the band, I don't also think that the band was in its healthiest shape it had been in. There was definitely some challenges. People were not as unified. It was not as unified. And I think Famous Last Words, even the title, really reflected that something had to change. I didn't expect it to be me, but it was really when my heart was telling me so strongly, okay, it's time. You've got to stop and take a backseat from the business and learn how to be a dad. That message really got in, and I made the very difficult decision.
It must have been a difficult decision. I'm sure all of us can appreciate the agony of that decision. Looking at your children today, I mean, looking at how they grew up, with your having made that decision, was it the right one? Can you see that you made a big difference in their lives doing that?
I hope so. I believe so. I mean, you know, they had as normal a childhood as they could have, but it been in a healthier. I left Los Angeles, which was the music center, and went up to a much healthier environment up in Northern California, up in the mountains, and they had a good life. They had a family that stayed together. They had a dad that was around, and my son's a musician. He learned a lot from me being around, and hopefully they don't have any regrets. I know I certainly don't, and they're in good shape. They're great.
And you and Rick Davies also seem to be in good shape. I mean, because you were a songwriting, well, not so much a combination because you wrote separately, but because you were a songwriting combo in that kind of Lennon and McCartney league, there were many reports over the years of rifts. But reading between the lines, it seems that the two of you are reasonably amicable.
Yes, they're really... I really don't... I mean, we were very, very different as people, but really I can't think of any major rift other than that, really. I mean, I loved his songs, his music. He liked my songs. I mean, we were a great kind of a polar opposites, if you like, which made for a very, very interesting dynamic within the band. And so, you know, I know there's been a lot of speculation, but, you know, it was very much like Lennon and McCartney. I mean, we kept the writer's credit as Davis Hodgson, probably for the same reasons Lennon McCartney did. It really avoids all kinds of arguments on who's going to have the first single and how many songs you've got on the album and all those things.
Yeah.
But we did write very separately, and I think that was because the songs were very personal. And for me, especially, I have to be alone to write and compose. And I think Rick's the same. I know Rick's the same. I mean, it became very personal, very individual, and yet was a great compliment on the albums.
All right, so there's respect there. But when you get asked the perennial question, Roger, you know, will there be another Supertramp or a Supertramp reunion, you always say, no, you can't see that. Is that still the case?
It is the case today. I mean, to tell you the truth, I have been very open to it through the years. And I've actually even talked to Rick about it even quite recently, but it never quite got off the drawing board for different reasons. And I think it's very hard. It's kind of like a marriage, you know. It's hard to go back into a marriage and expect the same magic that was there when you first got together. And even though, you know, I feel like the friendship and the respect is definitely still there, I don't know if I did it or we did it. It would be more because the people wanted, the fans wanted to see it more than I really wanted or needed to happen. Again, I have explored the idea for many times over the years, but as things stand now, I'm pretty sure it's not going to happen, and I don't see it happening, and I'm very happy with what's happening with my life and my relationship with my fans, and I know from them they're not disappointed when they see the show.
No, of course not. And the reviews that you read of your concerts amply illustrate that. But I was just thinking, it would be a promoter's dream. Mm-hmm. Someone would say to you, Roger, think of the money. You are quite a spiritual man, and I presume that money isn't your prime consideration as a performer or a human being these days either.
No, I've obviously been very blessed in my life. I mean, it's not a concern of mine, and it's not a real interest of mine. I mean, I really actually appreciate simple life more than accumulating houses or whatnot. So I'm more interested in keeping my life simple and doing what really feeds my heart and doing things where I'm able to give my heart. And as my song says, give a little bit of my love to the world and to audiences. And that's really what feeds me nowadays.
If you look up the Wikipedia entry on you, it contains intriguing sentences like, Roger spends hours before each show in quiet meditation preparing to sing inwardly from the deepest place within his heart and soul.
Wow, that's Wikipedia?
That's Wikipedia.
Wow, okay.
Which sounds enormously impressive. I've got to ask you, it's a clumsy sort of question, but what is your belief? What is the belief that impels your life?
Well, let me just go back to Wikipedia, because it's fascinating they say that. I mean, I wish I had that time available to to get myself centered before I go on stage. I mean, to me, though, I do take performing very seriously, and I don't want to, because I don't want to go on stage with my head and my heart full of all the events of the day and the stresses and the travel and everything else. I mean, I do feel responsible to kind of clear myself and get in a real good place in my being before I do go on stage, so I can give my best and sing from my heart, and people can feel that, because I know what it feels like when I'm not in that place, and I've heard the difference even in myself, and so it makes a big difference if I do get the time to do that. In terms of my spiritual beliefs, I really believe that the answer to feeling connected to our higher selves, to our true selves, to our soul, to our God self, in a way, is in our heart. And I think, we have got so far away from living life from our heart. And I think if I had to name a path that I'm on, it's really trying to clear all the debris away from my being and just really try to live from my heart day by day. It's a daily process. It's not like one day I suddenly have the answers and that's it. No, it's something I have to really work at every day to be the kind of man I want to be.
Right, so there was no epiphany. It was a gradual evolving of a simpler, better path for you.
Yes, it's definitely been an evolution. I mean, it's always been very present in my music. I mean, the songs that I wrote, especially when I was younger, I mean, the yearning and the longing and the questions that I had really were to do with, where do I belong? Where can I feel, my home is? What is God? Where can I find God? I mean, a lot of my love songs are actually to God. They're kind of disguised so people can receive them as a love song to a girl. But, I mean, there are some more overt ones, like Lord, Is It Mine? Only Because of You. But, as my songs really indicated, I mean, that is where I poured my deepest questions, my deepest longing. And Logical Song maybe sums it up. I mean, please tell me who I am. I mean, I really did want to know, having gone through my schooling and my upbringing, and at age 20, I was more confused than ever. So that was where I put my confusion, searching for answers.
Are you still searching? I mean, obviously you found some answers, but yes, those songs are famous for that questing, that wistful questing quality. Have you found a God of your understanding?
I'm definitely older and wiser, and I do have more answers, but the wonderful thing about life and God is that the mystery just keeps on getting bigger the more you find out, but which is good, because I think it really keeps us humble and it keeps us asking questions, because I think anyone who says they have all the answers, I think are kidding themselves. But for me, yes, I mean, I've had some incredible experiences, I've had some incredible heart openings, and really know that the place I need to look and get to is right here in my heart, and that's where I feel who I understand God to be, which is my closest, dearest friend, and he knows my, I'm a part of him, he's a part of me, and that's where I can connect with him and speak to him at any time.
How have you avoided then that ego amplification process, which is such a danger in your profession, especially when your work is as highly applauded as yours is?
Well, I think, I've gone through my own lessons with that. I mean, I know when you've had a hit album, for example, the expectations that are put on you, the expectations even I put on myself, are incredibly high. And And that can really twist your mind, twist everything, and even block the creative process, too. So I really do know the casualty rate in this business and any really entertainment business where people get famous. I mean, it's a hot fire to go through, if you like. But today, how I view it is that I'm very fortunate, I'm very grateful, and I'm very lucky to be an artist who has written songs that have made people, that have fed, that have made people, and that people want to hear. And to me, music is not a vehicle for me to go and get glorified or applauded. It's really a service industry. I really believe that it's spiritual food in its highest sense. And so I think if we approached it like that more, it would be easier to stay kind of humble and grateful for being having the opportunity to serve life and to serve people in that way, especially for anyone who's lucky enough to achieve success and make a living and achieve the kind of wonderful life that I've been able to live.
The brilliant Roger Hodgson is with us on Afternoons. It has been a life not without travail, though. I mean, In the Eye of the Storm sold millions, then you broke your wrists. You were told you'd never play again. That must have been a deeply testing, devastating time for you.
It was definitely a life change. It was difficult. Yes, obviously you can imagine. For me, so much of my identity and my life was wrapped up in what I loved to do, which was music. And to suddenly smash my wrists and have the doctor say, "Well, you'll never play again." That was the first thing I heard when I went to the hospital. It was devastating. I mean, I literally went into a depression for months. And it was really the day that I decided, okay, this is not supposed to be. I'm not going to accept what they tell me. I don't believe this. You know, I was given this gift. I want to use it. I want to give it back. And so I really started pulling and praying. And all the along with all the physical therapy and just sheer willpower and everything else, just really gathered all my focus and internal forces, if you like, to prove the doctors wrong. And it took a long time. It took about a year and a half before my wrists were really kind of back to semi-normal. But it worked, and you know, I overcome that. But it really taught me a lot about what was important in life. In that, you know, music is something I love to do, but it's not who I am. There's a man behind the music that I really need to be at peace with. And it stopped me hiding behind the music also. It taught me a lot. It was a very valuable experience, actually, in hindsight.
It sounds like you have a lot of peace in your life. I mean, that path of yours seems to have worked.
It has. I've been very blessed in finding some mentors and some teachers who have really taught me a lot of keys that have really changed my life, transformed my life. And one of the reasons that, you know, it's always a good mirror when I look at my musical journey, if you like, because with Supertramp, I was very introverted, very shy, very self-conscious, very unsure of myself, and couldn't speak on the microphone. I mean, it was very different to who I am today, where I can go and literally be solo on stage and just be very comfortable talking to thousands of people and just loving it. And feel very in my element and very very happy doing it too. So there's been it's a good reflection in a way of that I've been doing some things right in my life, and I have found some keys that really work for me.
Lovely to talk to you. A whole heap of people are looking forward very much to your appearances in New Zealand. Thank you for your time today, Roger.
My pleasure, Jim. I can't wait to get down there.
Roger Hodgson, our special guest on Afternoons.